goes down the city.
KBOO Camino Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 2nd from noon to 10 p.m. at St. Andrew's Church in Portland. This is the 10-year anniversary of the celebration of Dia de los Muertos in Portland. There will be altar building,
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Vote Together Portland. March to the ballot box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony in Portland. Join the Bus Project for a trip to the ballot box and a party to celebrate voting. Vote Together will meet at Dig a Pony at 6 p.m., then march up to the ballot box for red carpet voting, music, and more. Ballots are due on November 6th. Again, that's Vote Together Portland, March to the Ballot Box on Thursday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Dig a Pony, 736 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 9:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Radio Activist, and today, Shannon Olive has launched Rebuild Women First. She's here with her mother, Nita Ward, community organizers. And I'm Lisa Loving, live in Studio 2 with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. We're going to be taking your calls today. Let me go back and talk a little bit about Shannon's program, Women Organizing to pick up women being released from Coffee Creek, bring them home, and more. We're going to find out how that works. And Shannon, talk about this project. Why are you doing it? Where'd it come from?
So the project, hello everyone. My name is Shannon, and I am the founder and president for Women's First Transition and Referral Center. This project was a vision that the Lord had gave me back in 2007. And he gave me a confirmation to go forth in March of 2017. And the reason I'm doing it is because I have lived experience with my own life experience of being coming up as a young woman in foster care, having some life challenges, losing my own child when I was 16 to the state of Oregon, being adopted out of the system, being involved with, you know, street drugs, on drugs, a lot of different things, prostitution, and just having my own lived experience, losing my father at the age of 7. He was the first man in Oregon who donated his heart in 1985.
For a heart transplant, and, historic figure in the state.
Yes, and so the Lord gave me the vision when I was doing 30 days in Clark County and reached out to me and share with me, this is the assignment that I am putting you forth to help our people to rebuild their lives so that they can become successful. And so last March of 2017, as I was working as a resident service coordinator at Cathedral Gardens, which is a low-income apartment complex, it gave me the confirmation to go forth to with this project. The need is very important to help women to become empowered, to help women to rebuild their lives, to help women to become successful and have a productive life as citizens in our community.
We are talking live in Studio 2 with Shannon Olive, Rebuild Women First. What do you do? What does the program do? You're just getting started. So what do you do now? And then I want to move on to what your vision is for the future.
So what we do now, we've been up and on the ground running for a year and a half. And in that year and a half, we have two programs that we facilitate with that we're operating in our program. The first program that was launched last November is our I Love Me Women Empowerment Groups, because we truly believe in order for you to love anyone else, you must love yourself. So our Women Empowerment Groups, the curriculum focus on identity formation, value clarification. We promote healthy behaviors that increases the academic, social, and emotional and spiritual growth. And our most important thing is we help women to educate and learn to love and value themselves. Since November, we're coming up to actually November the 30th will be our year anniversary for our group starting. We've had three groups. This is October the 27th, 26th was our third group, and we've had 10 women who's graduated from our program. Our second program that we have operating out of our organization is our peer mentorship program that is based out of Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, where we serve women 6 months prior to their release. It's very a key, valuable program. We work with them. We're there at Coffee Creek on the second and fourth Mondays of each month for 2 hours. We work with the women. We help them to provide information, resources, get to know, build relationships, make connections, and develop a trust. You know, it takes a little time for people to get to know who you are before they can actually really open up to you to get to for them to know who you are, who they are. One of the valuable things about our program is we work with them to create an action plan, and the action plan is based off of their needs and what they would like to see happen in their life. And as the mentors, we are certified. Then we then go out and find what resources and services and programs that coincide with their action plan. So as they are working in the prison upon their release, they have a sense of direction. They have an action plan where they can re-enter back into the community and navigate with those resources and services so that they can have a successful plan to be on a successful path to get back into the community. On the flip side of the coin, the most important thing I feel that is truly a blessing for them is that when they go and meet with their POs or parole officers, because they have to do that, they can then take that action plan and present it to them and let them see, hey, this is something that I created for myself. That way, not only are they presenting something, but it's allow us together to work with them as their support system to help them to be able to work on what that action plan is that they have created, and help them to be successful. But then it also puts it back on them to hold them accountable to making sure, ensuring that they are following through to accomplish their goals and meeting their needs.
We are listening to Shannon Olive talk about Rebuild Women First. Shannon, you know, as we bring people onto this show, The Radio Activist, which is a new show, I'm just getting this sense growing inside me that I always land in my feelings on this show. I'm trying to stop, right? But there's so much that we do as just people out here. We're the ones that are the actual leaders. I know Election Day is next week. I know we're voting. I know that we have elected political leaders. But you're reminding me that it's us that are the real leaders, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yes.
And this is another one of those examples where we're talking with someone who's organizing something, but you're creating the microcosm of what our wider society should be. You're literally weaving and painting the picture of who we should be within the work you're doing, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so you're literally taking a tool and you're lopping off part of society and you're organizing that.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, y'all, this is how it should be. I heard you say that the people participating with you are certified mentors?
Yes.
What is that? How does that work? I want to hear more about that. I bet a lot of people listening right now would love to leap into that.
Yes. So we Certified mentors is basically people who has lived experience. One of the things that we learned in the recovery world is that people that has lived experience that can work with other people who's been through trauma, who's been on drugs, who's been in dysfunctional families, who's been and have kids that's been in the DHS system, who's been in lived in a struggle. It's better to be able to relate to someone else that has been in that situation or dealt with those different type of issues than to have someone that has a bachelor's degree or a associate's degree or has a master's degree.
They went to college to learn poverty. Sorry, that was so rude. And I want to honor everyone who has that vision to do something good. Go ahead.
Yes. And I'm not minimizing the degree because I do have an associate's degree myself. Graduated in 2015 from Portland Community College and my major is criminal justice. But the key value to having peer mentors out there in the world is that they have lived experience. So when you're working with someone that has lived a struggle, when you sit down and you talk to them and you guys are talking about, you know, well, my son was taken from DHS, or you talked about that drug that you used to be on and you end up relapsing, or you talked about, you know, having a trigger to have a moment to go out and do something that caused you to do the things that you used to do, that peer mentor then can talk about, well, I know what you've been through. I know what happened. I experienced that. This is what I did to make it better. And they can then relate to the person, and the person that there in that moment, there is the relationship that's built. There's a connection that's made. There's trust that's been given because of the fact that you have people that are there that can relate to your experience versus someone that has went to school, like you said, and learned about poverty and that have to remember what did that page on 92 said I'm supposed to do when I'm in this situation and how do I approach the situation to help this person get their needs met. So having the relationship with a peer mentor is very important, is very key, and it helps to build those relationships and it helps to support that person that's in the situation and get those needs met. On the flip side of the coin, certified mentors, we have to go through our trainings. Yes, we do. Eric Martin, which is ACBO, and we go through a 40-hour training. We also have to go out and do community services before we get our certification. After we get our certification, then we are continued to participate in meetings every month just to get that extra curriculum, just to get the extra information, the resources, what services is out there, so that we can ensure that we are meeting the needs of the clients that we're serving within our organizations.
I would guess too that part of what's really frustrating about being in any kind of I want to say institution is just trying to cope with the bureaucracy of it. And as you're talking about peer mentors, you're talking about connecting with, I'm just going to say our sisters that are behind the walls.
Yes.
These are our families.
Yes.
I want to talk about that a little bit later. Like, you know, the stereotypes of how we think of people differently when we know they're incarcerated, but I want to come back to this. Like, I've interviewed people for years about the conditions in our jail system in Oregon, our prison system. It's not the same. And then you have Columbia, you know, you have the local jail right here. There are actually really cool people working in those facilities. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult for us on the outside that don't have the lived experience to understand the bureaucracy of even trying to figure out someone that I love. I'm going to think about my nephew who was incarcerated in California.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful person. Like, how do we help him deal with the person over him who's threatening him all the time, who's not even the same person that he has to please when he goes before some sort of board when they decide to let him loose?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much bureaucracy that's not even a book that anyone wrote their master's degree
yes.
on, like how to cope with that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about our sisters who are inside? What's on their minds?
Mm-hmm.
What are they dealing with day to day?
So what we've learned is a lot of the women that we've been working with, they shared with us, you know, just one of the things that we've hear a lot is coming home to their families and getting the services, getting the programs, getting the connections that they need so that they don't have to come back to this place. A part of our intake, we have an intake that we do with the women, and then we have a questionnaire that we asked about the life, the lived experience that they had when they were in Coffee Creek. And so one of the things that we saw, you know, that came up is that the treatment, you know, how they've been treated, you know, and what happens is the way they get treated, it causes them to just isolate themselves because of the treatment, the staff not understanding who they are, what they've been through, and just looking at them as a number, you know, another number that's coming into the prison.
Dehumanizing.
Exactly. And so what they have shared with us is that they have their own perception of, you know, I'm in here, I need to serve my time, I need to get everything that I can get possibly so that I can get home to my children and families. They don't, you know, what they have shared is there's not a lot of things that they can do when there is some programs, but it's not some programs that's pertaining to what they need in order for them to re-enter back into the community. So they do what they can to take each day at a time so that they can be able to help themselves versus getting help from the staff or the folks that are inside of the prison that's working inside of those places.
Can you tell me some of the things that they actually need or would like that they feel that that is not being provided?
Yeah, that was another question I had. Last night, had a bunch of people over for dinner. One of our friends that came for dinner, she's got to go to prison in 9 days. In 9 days. And I'm looking at her. Okay, we're here. We're having a hot chicken dinner. This is great. How do we support you?
So are you talking about inside of the prison or after they come out?
Both, actually. I'm interested. You know, what are the things that are not being met that people that women would like to have more of or see more of, both in the prison and when they get out?
Well, for one, the inside of the prison, what we've learned is our organization for our peer mentorship is something that they are so excited to have someone to come in and mentor them, to build that relationship, to make that connection, to just get to know who they are so that they can have a better life once they exit the prison. Because a lot of times we know that there's a lot of agencies that work with women once they get out, but then being able to have that source to be able to come in before they're exiting so that they can be able to have that sense of direction, have that plan on what they need to do once they exit the prison. And so with the five women that has already been released that we've worked with and we're working with, they have shared with us, this is, we could have not asked for anything better to have you all come in and be of a support for us because we didn't have this source. And of course there was different agencies or different organizations that's come in to do different groups and different things, but not someone that actually take the time out to really hear from me.
So it's partly personal support and really listening that women would like.
Human connection.
It's really to get, you know, really getting to know who they are, you know, and what their needs are. It's not about us. It's at the end of the day, it's about them and learning who they are and what they value in their lives and empowering them to become better, to love themselves, to value themselves, and to become successful and know how to advocate for themselves when they are re-entering back into the community. And then that helps us as an organization to be able to know what we can do to be more effective, to be able to meet the needs for the women that we're serving. Once we hear from them, because we as people, yes, we are mentors, yes, we are humans, and we have our own experience. We know what life is all about, but it's also important to listen to them and hear from them, get to know them, understand them, learn from them so that we can be able to meet and support what they are in need of.
You know, okay, if you just tuned in, now I'm just falling down the rabbit hole of this conversation. This is us. This is our society. we don't have this conversation enough, and there's so many distractions. If you just tuned in, you are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. We are live in Studio 2 with Shannon Olive and Nita Ward from Rebuild Women First. Hey, why Rebuild Women First?
Well, you know, as I can say, as women, we go through a lot. We wear many hats. We have the tendency to put everyone and everything first. And so one of the things that really stood out is that we, as an organization, we want to put women first. We not only want to put them first, but we want to help rebuild their lives, regain their self-dignity, their hope, their self-worth. Because of the fact, one of the things our organization's logo says, I love me. And again, as we shared, in order for you to love anyone else, you must love yourself. The colors of our organization is red and white, and those colors represent something. The white represents the white that shines within each woman, and the red represents the essence of the heart that strives for success. So most definitely, we truly believe that here at Women's First, we could have said first women in our march. We did that as well. But we truly believe that we are first. We have put down our, bowed down. We have been through so much. We have lived experience. We have trauma in our life, dysfunctional families. We have suffered. And so through that, even with my own experience in my life, with my mother here, with the stuff that she's been through, her struggles, she's my first testimony for Women's First. That is the importance, most valuable thing is allowing women to know that you are first. You are number one. You are number one. When you believe that, you say that, you share that, you value that for yourself, then life is going to be so much better for you because you're putting yourself first before you put anyone else first.
So how do you do that? I mean, that seems like an incredibly tall order, especially since, you know, we've had a whole lifetime. We have a culture that you know, says that women are not first. You know, so you are basically reversing a whole lifetime of messages. How do you do that?
Goes back to that issue of here's the small place you're working, but you're shifting the whole dominant paradigm.
I mean, I think you have absolutely nailed it. But how? I think people struggle with those questions all the time.
Well, the first thing I want to say is I give all glory to God. Yes. He is my everything. He's the one that has given me the vision for this ministry. And he's given me this assignment. And with my, again, going back to my own lived experience and how he... I went through what I went through as a young woman, as a teenager, as an adult. He shared that, revealed that life to me, and showed me that I went through what I went through. Now I have covered you, and I saved you, and I was able to mold you and grow you and clay you to the woman that I created you to be. Now I want you to take what I've given you and I want you to share it with other women, because if I can do it for you, I can do it for them. And so with that being said, I truly believe in my heart. I look at myself every morning. I get up. You are very beautiful. You have come a long way in your life. I have to tell myself that every day. You have come a long way and you are still here. You're a living witness of what you've been through and where you are today. And so with that being said, I want to be able to share with other women that I can do it. You can too. Whatever you went through in your life, we all went through something, but at the same time, it can change. You can become a better person, and you can also put you first because you are someone. And so it's just the, like you said, women's first, women's first, women's first, because we are the creator. You know, God created Adam and Eve, but when he created Adam, he had to give him Eve. So, and then I look at in today's society, it's a women's movement going on as well. We're coming back. You know, we went through a lot with all the women's rights and all those different things that they had going on for us. But now we're taking over this world because we are first.
We actually were in control the whole time. That's the thing that gets me. And I can say that, and it sounds like a lot of hyperbole, but it's true, I think, and to the degree that we can. And our transgendered sisters, I'm putting that out, and my gender non-binary brothers, sisters, everyone, like, we actually are the ones in charge. And
that's
and
right.
They're so, it's really hard, Suzanne, to sit and say, and to love yourself as a woman in the United States.
It is.
I'm sure that there is in other places too. And I know that there's class and race and there's narcissists everywhere and there's all these issues, but damn, we can figure this out. If we could just push the smoke and mirrors out of the way.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, it strikes me that, you know, what you're doing is you're creating a container, that a relationship, mm-hmm. right, that allows you to see the world differently.
Yes.
So that's, and maybe also to tell stories, right, to tell the stories of what is true for you, what has happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious if maybe storytelling and also relationships are a really big part of how you are doing this work. It sounds to me like that.
It is. It's a really a great piece of the work that we do, because one of the things that we discuss in our empowerment groups is that our empowerment groups are 12 weeks. It's a close group. We meet with the women once a week for 90 minutes, but we're changing it to 2 hours because we're implementing a workbook in our groups. It's not just a group that you just come and you just hang out and just listen to each other's issues and problems, which is important. But we have video clippings, we have motivational speakers, we have homework assignments, we have evaluations, we have dialogue discussions.
Structure, yes. So that people can change and
yes.
you can see, yeah, this is organizing.
Yes, it's a relationship building, because one of the things that we feel that is very important is that we want to know the women that is a part of our organization. We want to know their story, because as we share with them, your story can change someone else's life. You don't know who's out there that has been through what you've been through or are going through what you're going through now, and that can see you and say, wow, look at her. I'm going through that. I went through that. But look what she went through, or look what she's going through, and look how she's changed today. My sister Lori Palmer, she's always said, your misery is your ministry. So what you've been through is your past and it's your misery, but now it's your ministry to share it to someone else that can change a person's life.
So it sounds like you're also teaching people in that group to be mentors too.
Yes.
That's brilliant. I like what you're saying about adversity, because it's adversity life is about overcoming adversity. It's not about the fingernail polish. And it's easy for us to forget that in our society, I think. But I wanted to come back. It's a thread of the same thought. What does the outside world not understand about our family that's inside? We tend to even, it's like different filters that show up suddenly. That we can't think straight, like, oh, someone must have done something bad if that happened, even though we know that's not true. Do you mm-hmm. understand me?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that we don't understand?
Well, I think that, for one, I think they don't understand that they're people, they're humans. Because even looking at the crimes of the women that's recently been put in jail for the last 2 to 3 years, you know, you have property crimes, you have property crimes, you have drug crimes. And I truly feel that with the society, the justice system knowing about these different crimes that are in the community, and they are not doing nothing about it to prevent people from going to the institutions. When you look up and you constantly seeing jails being built because they have a perception of knowing that people are going to fill up these prisons and these jails, that's really heart-filling to me, because it's like, how can you make more jails, prisons, instead of putting more money into, you know, recovery centers or transitional housing or to education versus institutions. And then on the flip side of that, when a person is put in prison, there's not a lot of programming inside of the prison to help them to become a better person. So once they get out, they have that sense of pride or sense of, you know, humanity or sense of feeling like, okay, I went to this space, I did my time, I did a crime, but while I was in, I was able to get what I needed, so I can go out and I can be the better person that I need to be for my family, for my community, for myself, so that I don't have to come back into this place. Another thing is that I disagree with is once people does get out, it's like it's a double jeopardy. You get out, now you're a felon to society. You already did your time. Now you have a category, or you have a stereotype, or you have a label on you. So now society sees you as not this person, but they see you as a felon, which is that label. So now you are decriminalized as this felon where you can't get jobs, you can't get housing, you can't go back to school, you can't get the things that you need in order to become a successful person. So when that happens, people does give up hope for themselves because they're trying to do the best that they can so that they can become successful. But then you have society who's knocking them down and putting those barriers in their way to cause them to not be able to be the person that they're looking to be. And then what happens is a trigger. Well, I got to make money. I got to take care of my family. I got to do this. I got to do that. So what do I have to do in order to get what I need? I have to go back to my old ways. And then what happens? They reoffend. They go back to using drugs. They go back to doing these things that they was doing in the past, and then here they are back in prison, back in jail, back in on drugs again. And when you think about money, society, the systems are getting money, they're continuing to get paid for people, but they're not giving money to help better people,
right?
And that is so I can't get over. They're not giving money to agencies, organizations, so that they can be able to help the people, to help them to become a better person.
So it sounds like what you've described is that we have a system that wants people to be in jail.
Yes.
And has an economic incentive to keep them there.
It's for money. You know, it's all for money. It's a revolving door. It's like, you know, I'm going to use housing, which is a big issue for anybody. If you're in prison, whether you're homeless or whatever. Okay, so they have all this money to provide for the homeless, you know. Okay, but then here you have homeless people that are meant to have mental issues. They're, you know, drug addicted. You know, and all these things that before you place them in housing, I think that they should be assessed for drug addiction. If you have drug addiction, go to treatment first. If you have mental health, get your mental health issues together. You need job readiness next, get that done. And then, you know, of course, rent well class, whatever it is you need, get that done. Then you get housing. See, it's phases that they need to go through. Now, I'm going to use example of an agency that they provide services for housing. Okay, but here you got these people that, you know, they have a day center. You have these people that come down there every day. They can get mail. They can get showers. Okay, well, I feel when you get mail and showers, then you should have a schedule, you know, a daily schedule. Go get your counseling. Go to your job readiness, you know, these phases that you have to go through instead of taking these people that are using drugs outside of the day center that are waiting to get housing, you stick them right in housing. 4 months later from the drug addiction, they're already evicted, but they're back down at the day center waiting to get more housing. What happens to the people that have never had a chance to get it?
So what I hear you saying, you're literally pointing, and I feel like you've actually been in all those situations that you're describing. So you're not just, you didn't just read a book and you're giving your opinion. Right. You've been in all those situations that you're describing.
Right.
And so we're describing systems that are taxpayer-funded systems. Some of them have been semi-privatized, such as the prison system, maybe not so much in Oregon, but maybe it has. And so you're talking about how we have one side of our, you know, our government systems that theoretically provide services, but the system is broken and can't possibly work. Mm-hmm. We don't really have functioning mental health systems in the United States.
Exactly.
Which is fascinating in itself. But then you're talking...
Or drug rehabilitation.
Which I would even, I would even theoretically even put them in the same thing. Like if there's something wrong with your head, there's not a lot of places you can go without... I mean, we've seen in this country where a lot of the homeless problem, the housing problem came from people who had gigantic medical debts and lost their homes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting when we... When we pass the stick, we pass the microphone, we pass the PowerPoint to real people with lived experience, and you're out there going, you know, do you see how this stuff doesn't add up, mm-hmm. but we're paying for all of it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like a gigantic spoon in a great big pot, and it doesn't do anything. So on one hand, we are trying to go in through Rebuild Women First. We're literally looking around and going, okay, there's an earthquake. There's a hurricane coming. We can maybe create shelter and try to save some individual people's worlds. And that's what we're doing right now. We're trying to figure out if we can help our sisters and moms, right? Those people are some of the brightest.
Yes.
So if we try to help people, bring them into a safe place, maybe together we'll figure out the next step, which is so frustrating. And it's going to be election day next week. And as usual, I have to say this because I'm freaking out. I know a lot of people are freaking out for a lot of different reasons. We have our personal lives and then our political lives. And can we even walk down the street?
Right.
I feel wigged out walking down the street personally. I've been physically attacked. And I think it's because I'm a woman, a female human being. But I'm not the only person. There's other people who can't walk down the street without law enforcement following them. And I've seen that with my eyeballs.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. That blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a level, I feel like, what I love about this show, you're listening to The Radio Activist on KBOO Portland, we can dig into a different level of what organizing means. Because one of the things that's happening right now is that the dominant paradigm, I guess we'll say the 1%, you could say Trump or Stump or whatever you want, but there's a 1% that's bigger than that one orange man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Those people are up there, they're stampeding us back and forth emotionally in this country right now, right? And Donald Trump is their puppet, I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to save each other. We literally are seeing each other dying in the street, sometimes by our own hand.
Yes.
Honestly.
Right.
We haven't even talked about that yet. And because that is so real, and that goes to what you're talking about, the self-love piece. But we're just stampeding back and forth in this country. And what I see is many of us would end up on TV or on our phones or shopping on Amazon trying to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're talking about the systems. What do the systems do?
Yeah.
And even this incarceration system, it impacts the elections because how many people can't vote now?
Exactly.
Yes.
So when you, I mean, this stuff is systematic. So as we're talking about radio activism, talking about organizing and talking about active stuff, it's complicated. There's layers to it. But that's why I love what you're doing. You're reaching out person to person. And that it has to start there. It can't start. We can't make this change from the top down.
Right.
No.
I love you, Democrats. Okay, but we have to do it from the bottom up.
Grassroots.
And that's the slow food movement of the political world.
Yes.
But I mean, God, what are your thoughts about the election? I have to give it to you, Shannon. You know stuff.
Well, you know, I can truly say my thoughts about election. I got into the social justice movement in 2004 when I joined an organization called Oregon Action. That was under the leadership of Joanne Bowman, who is Joanne Hardesty now, and she's running for city council.
Yay.
Kate Titus and Johnny Gage. And at that time,
Titans.
Yes. At that time, it was the John Kerry and President Bush election. And when Johnny Gage had approached me at that time, I was just, I was actually in school, going to school to get my diploma at Concord Career Institute. And he approached me. I was going to Popeyes on MLK and Ainsworth. And he said, "Hey, Shannon, what are you doing these days?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to school to get my diploma. And he was like, "You know, I'm part of this organization." Introduced me. And I, at that time, I've never voted. Never voted. Didn't care about voting. Didn't care if it mattered. Didn't care if my vote counted. None of that. So he introduced me. He had me come in. I went through a leadership development training, and when I learned more about the importance of voting and that our vote does count, and that the importance of educating myself and educating others, I became a volunteer with Oregon Action, and I was there for 4 years, hitting the ground running. In 2004, I registered over 1,000 new registered voters that year. It was so amazing because I couldn't believe myself. This is when I saw another side of me when we talk about leadership, that I had a leadership embedded in me as a person to be able to, when you talk about grassroots, getting out there on the ground, talking to people, knocking on doors, person-to-person relationship. That's when I actually found myself as a leader in our community. And from there, I was on the ground. I was like one of their hottest volunteers. We went from one thing to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And I was excited. Hey, I'll do it. Just because I was like, this is important. And the three E's that I continue to follow is my model that I learned at Oregon Action was to educate, engage, and empower. And so my thing about election is so important. You know, we have a lot of people have the tendency to vote during presidential election, which is good. But the primary elections, the elections that happens after the press is the most effective ones that really pertains to our, when you talk about community issue, lives and different things that affect us as community. And so I encourage everybody that's listening, get those votes in November the 6th. Tomorrow is going to be, if you want to mail it so it can get in on time, tomorrow is the last day. And I encourage everyone to participate. There's a lot of measures out there that we need to take part in and be a part so that we can make a difference and change in our community.
All right. And we are live in studio too. I'm Lisa Loving. With my friend and compatriot Suzanne LeGrand, and we are talking with Shannon Olive and Nita Ward, Rebuild Women First. I believe that's rebuildwomenfirst.org, maybe, even.
Yeah.
So you have an event coming up in mid-November. Can we talk about that a little bit? What are you doing?
Yes. So we're having our dinner, our dinner fundraising event. And so it's going to be Saturday, November the 17th, 3:30 to 6 p.m. at the Fourth Dimension Recovery Center, located at 3807 Northeast MLK Boulevard.
Tony Vezina,
Portland, Oregon 97212. Tony Vezina, who is our good friend of ours. We appreciate you, Tony,
Yay.
For allowing us to use your space.
We've had him on these airwaves.
Supporting us, yes. And so the reason for our event is we are coming together just to get more information out to the community members, to learn more about our organization, the work, great work we've done, and our plans moving forward. This will be an opportunity to learn from our collaborators and our partners in ways we're working together to rebuild lives. Bridges to Change, yes.
Yes.
I love Bridges to Change.
Yes.
Monta Knutson, Shelley Mead, they have been a wonderful partner and mentor of ours. We've connected with them September of last year, and they have really helped us in a much mighty way to help us get going and getting up on our feet as a new women's organization. This is also be an opportunity for folks who participate and attend the event to hear from the women who are a part of our organization, to hear from them how the organization has impacted their lives and what they are, the benefit that it has done for them and what their interests as far as moving forward with us and how they're looking to continue on with the organization. It's also an opportunity. You can come. We'll have raffle prizes. We'll have music. We'll have food. But the proceeds from the fundraiser will go towards a company van. We are in need of a company van. A lot of the work that we do, we help women to schedule appointments. We help women go to NA empowerment groups. We also we out at Coffee Creek on the second and fourth Mondays of each month, and we're there to pick the women up when they are released from prison.
This is really important if yes. you're listening right now. You might be thinking, big BFD, who cares about that? It's really crucial to have someone there, because also it kind of holds the system accountable.
Yes.
We've seen people who have been released from the local jails. I'm going to say the Injustice Center. They get released at 2 o'clock in the morning,
yes.
3 o'clock in the morning. What
yes.
are they supposed to do?
Right.
I've had friends that were in the facility who were literally trading information about what dumpster someone should sleep behind, because this is a safer dumpster. This is how important it is.
Can yes,
you just talk about
is.
That a little? When you go, what happens when you go?
Yes. So we just recently had, about a couple of weeks ago, we had three women in 2 days that we was there to pick up and celebrate. And that moment for me and my mother, it was so
uplifting, amazing. It was a beautiful feeling.
A beautiful feeling. And just for one of the women, she had her kids there, her sister there to pick her up. But for us to just to be there to support and celebrate her, that was a goal win for her, just because we was there. If her sister wasn't there to pick her up, we was there. And so she just felt so good because of the fact that we had already been inside of the prison, mentoring with her, working with her, and for her to see us there at the gates when she exited the prison. The other two women, they just was like, you're here. You know, that it was this, I don't know if it was a doubt in their mind to say, is they really going to be here to pick us up, to be here to, you know, but when they opened up that gate and they saw our faces, it was a moment of glorious. I mean, we all cried. It was just, we have footage of it.
I was going to say,
yes.
So I wanted to ask you about your use of social media, because Suzanne, she's really big on storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
She feels strongly, and that's why she had to bring that up. She teaches people storytelling,
mm-hmm.
and she's saying, I need to hear more of these stories.
Yes.
So in my social media, I'm not going to say the social media, because they've got enough money and they don't need more plugs by me.
Right.
But you always catch my attention because I'm strolling through there, as my old boss used to say, and I see you and you're live. I feel like you're living from.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that when you have you done that every time you pick people up, or?
Well, since in this,
because it's exciting.
Yeah,
yeah.
This was our first pickup that we had in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we truly believe that it's important to have footage, because one of the things that I call it is a receipt. Because if it wasn't written, it didn't happen. If you didn't have a documentation, it didn't, it didn't matter. So we
right.
truly feel like a live footage. I mean, we can talk about what we do, who we are, and different things, but it's another thing when you have something to prove, or you have the actual women coming to share their story. And so we got to have this on live footage so that we can share this to the people, to let them see that we are really doing the work that we say we're doing. So if you come and attend our dinner event, we will have a slideshow presentation of all the work that we've done from January. We just recently had a graduation for our five women that graduated from the I Love Me Women Empowerment Group. But we'll have a slideshow presentation to present from the work that we've done in this last 10 months. And we have those footage of those clippings from the women that's been released, have been released from prison, and also the women who shared their story about how the empowerment groups have impacted their lives as well.
Okay, because, and I have some events to read. I'm gonna push that back a little later. Do you remember that lady that wrote that book, Women Who Run With the Wolves? It was this women's empowerment book from the 90s, maybe,
mm-hmm.
right? Clarissa Pinkola Estes. I know, I'm looking at Patricia Kohlberg, the engineer, and I'm like, I don't know. But she talked about how we might not be able to save the world, but we can save individual people's worlds.
Yes. Exactly.
And that actually matters a lot.
Yes.
I don't even know what it means to save the world, because we don't even all agree on what the world should be. So, but when you're talking about, you know, we went there in the past few weeks, we picked up three women, that's three universes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Exactly.
And I kind of want to shift gears a little and talk about your family. I know that it's your personal life,
mm-hmm.
but when we're talking about my nephew,
that was incarcerated in California the year before the state shut down the entire juvenile youth authority because it was abusive, whatever. Mm. We're talking about our hearts. We're talking about the fabric of who we are inside, right? Yes. Because family is the microcosm of society. Family is where society starts. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about like being there for three women, that might not sound like the most impactful thing in the world, but mm-hmm. it really is.
It is.
And I remember even when we were debating even building Coffee Creek, there were thousands of people saying, we don't actually have a need for that. But the people that won that argument said, yeah, but build it and they'll come. We talk about systems. So can you talk a little bit about finding your son? And I also want to talk about your dad. Your family, you guys have traveled the world emotionally.
Yes.
And so, and the reason I'm bringing this up, this is the radio activist. We're out there, we think we want to do something to make the world a better place, but I'm busy now. I'm depressed now. I don't know if I can do it, right?
Right.
Now I want to hear from you. What did you do besides the fact that you were So talk about finding your son. What happened with your son? Because I still haven't even heard that story. I want to hear every piece of it.
Yes. So when I was 16 years old, I was in foster care and I ran away from my foster home. I lived there for 8.5 years. Ran away when I was 15 and a half. I had my firstborn when I was 16 years old. He was born May 6th of 1996. When he was born, at that time of my life, of course, I was living a life. I was selling drugs and, you know, doing things that I was doing to survive. At that time, when I had him, I didn't know that, you know, when you sell drugs, it can get in the pores of your skin and, you know, it can get into your system or anything like that. We had a community health nurse that would come out to our house and just kind of, I guess she was doing outreach just to kind of seeing how things was going, seeing what I needed or different things like that. When I would go in for my care at the hospital, they would ask me questions where they were looking to check to see if I had any sugar in my urine or different things, check my blood. But come to find out, they was actually looking to see if there was any drugs in my system. And they did that for a lot of the different times I came to the hospital. They had me signing paperwork that I shouldn't have been signing at the age of 16 because I was a minor. It should have been a parent or guardian there to assist me at that time, but I didn't know any of these things. So the day that I had my son, May 6th of 1996, there was a CSD worker from DHS that came in and she told me her name and she said, I'm going to be your caseworker. And once you have been released from the hospital, you will not be taking your son home with you. And so I was devastated. I actually went off and started going crazy in the hospital. At that time, they had bracelets that you could put on your arm just to identify who you are and who your child is. Because I guess that people were taking people's kids. So, I was trying to figure in my mind, I'm going to take my son and we're going to leave out of here because they want to take my son from me. I'm going to take him from them, you know? But I couldn't. So after I left from the hospital, I would have supervised visits. And during those supervised visits, my son was a baby, so I would lay him on my chest just to bond with him because he was just a baby.
And A newborn.
And I would just come in there and just lay on the couch and just bond with him and just talk to him. But they put it in the paperwork that I was coming to the visits going to sleep and that if something could have happened, he could have rolled off and fell and hit his head. So it was always a negative thing that they had coincide of what I was doing just to keep something negative in my
record. And by they, we mean the CSD caseworkers.
The CSD systems, yeah.
The system.
So then they had a lot of different stipulations. They wanted me to go to parenting class. They wanted me to go to school. They wanted me to go drug and alcohol. They wanted me to go to get a job. It was like 12 different things that they wanted me to do. And I argued like, well, I only can do two things at a time because it's 24 hours in a day. Once I get those done, can I come back and get the rest of the things? They didn't agree with that. I had three family members that came forth to try to get my son. Each of those family members had a criminal background, had something on their record that they refused or rejected to give them to their care. Over the years, I ended up writing a letter to the judge, caseworker, and to the Department of Human Services. I got a call from the lawyer saying that my son was adopted out of the system. They prior to that, real quick, they had sent a letter for my parental rights. I never got a letter for that court date. They sent a letter to my aunt saying about the adopted court date. She never got a letter. So they did all this without me being in the courtroom. Then I got the letter call from the lawyer saying, your son has been adopted. His name is still the same. And he lives in the state of Oregon. And I said, well, can I get the address so I can at least send him, you know, papers and pictures and letters? No, you cannot. So that was the end of the discussion. So I was just really sad. And I felt lonely. I felt depressed. I felt like my son
traumatized.
Yes, my son is gone. Like, what am I going to do now? So, you know, later as time, I ended up finding out somebody said when he turns 18, you can reach out to the Oregon Adoption Register. They can help you. So over the time, over the years, I began to start doing my search. And every time I came up to try to find him, I came up against a brick wall. Even through the Oregon Adoption Register place, I didn't ever hear anything back from them. My son, my second son, he went on Facebook to try to find. We thought we had him, but it wasn't the young man. I reached out to another young man. It wasn't him. Then it was the last thing. My cousin, she sent a picture of me, the picture of my son when he was 6 months. I posted it up on Facebook. Hey, if anybody's seen him, if anybody knows somebody that knows my son, please contact me. I haven't seen my son in 21 and a half years. And so I was just, please, I'm trying to find my baby. I haven't seen my son. I need to see him. I want to reunite with my baby. And so the Spirit of the Lord had been speaking to me for the last couple months and telling me that I'm getting ready to go into a new chapter of my life. I just turned 40 on October the 28th, and he was just sharing these things with me. Well, on October the 21st, I was at church, and I was praying, and he shared with me that eyes haven't seen, ears haven't heard what I'm getting ready to do for you in your life. When I got home later on that night, I was talking to my mom. I went in. There was two pieces of mail on the bed, and I picked up one of the letters, and I was like, who is this from? I don't know. Maybe they're reaching out for the organization. I open up the letter, and as I begin to read, when I got to, I'm trying to find.
I know, right? I'm crying too. Biological
mom. I fell on the ground, and I started crying, and I was like, oh my gosh, and I started crying. I started laughing at the same time, and my mom ran in. She was like, what's going on, Shannon? What's happening? And I was like, Mom, it's Davion. He's reached out to us. He found us, Mom. He's here. She was like, okay, Shannon, breathe. Just breathe. This is what you've been with. I said, I know, Mom, but I'm so excited. My son has reached out to us. He's wanting to find his biological mom. He did his own investigation. He matched everything up, and he found us. And so all that time, they had changed his name to something else. So when I was trying to reach out and find him, I couldn't because his name had been changed to something else, and I didn't know. Well, then I ended up writing him a letter. I went on Facebook, and I Googled the name that he had been changed to, and I started scrolling on the pictures, and I was like, look at my son.
He looks just like you.
Yes.
He looks just like you.
Yes.
He looks just like you. All right. I got to grab the show back. I got to grab the show back like a great big bunch of roses.
Yes.
I want to cry. Okay, listen.
Yes.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving. We're live in this room with Shannon Olive and Nita Ward. We're talking about how do we organize to make our lives better? How do we organize to make the world better? That's what we've been talking about. Now we're crying because we like connected with each other. I mean, the point of this discussion is there's a lot of people listening right now who you want to go out and you want to do something, but you're worried that you're busy or you're depressed or you're going to drop the ball or you can't focus on it. Listen, there's never going to be a convenient time, y'all. Okay? So, so Shannon, Olive, tell us one more time, our listeners right now, how do they connect with you to support your work?
So you can connect with me. Our website is www.rebuildwomenfirst.org. Or you can contact me through my email, Shannon, S-H-A-N-N-O-N, the letter O, at rebuildwomenfirst.org. Or you can call me, 503-875-1725.
Excellent. So real quickly, events. This afternoon at 5, it's going to be RIP ICE. That's at the Terry Shrunk Plaza. November 1st, all of our friends that were arrested trying to shut down the ICE Center, there's Pack the Courthouse, continuing legal support for legal defendants. That's at the downtown courthouse. Also Thursday is, again, the 7 to 9 p.m. book discussion and reading with Dr. Adonia Lugo on bicycle race. That's at Bikes for Humanity PDX. There's a wonderful annual spaghetti dinner fundraiser coming up on Friday. It's for all those warming shelters in Southeast Portland. It's the Muse and SWS Spaghetti Dinner Fundraiser. Look for that. And of course, November 17th, we're going to the Fourth Dimension Recovery Center at 3 p.m. for Shannon's banquet fundraiser. So I have to close out this show, y'all. Okay, so I have to say thanks to our guests. It was such a joy sitting
in
this room with you.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Honestly. And we didn't even talk about your dad. Next time we're going to do it. Organ transplantation is a part of this family's history, too. We're just looking at each other going, what? I want to say thanks to our engineer, the incredible Patricia Kohlberg.
Yes.
Thank you.
Original music for this show by Ms. Deluxe. The KBOO volunteer coordinator is Ani Haynes. Radical inclusion is her game. Contact her to be a volunteer at this station. That's volunteer at kboo.fm. The next volunteer orientation will be held Monday, December 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at KBOO Community Radio. We're at 20 Southeast 8th. You could be behind this mic because we are radioactive. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Good morning and happy Halloween from KBOO, your community radio. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up on the BOO this morning at 11, we have a special presentation. It's the Why Arts and Culture Matter Forum, featuring the two runoff candidates for Portland City Council, Loretta Smith and Joanne Hardesty. And now, stay tuned for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Art-A-Thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Art-A-Thon with Impact is a 12-hour creativity and wellness festival. Young people are invited to participate in groups. In 8 hours, each group will create an original artwork that is connected to themes of mental health and wellness. A festival from 6 until 9 showcases all performances and artwork open for all to attend. Again, that's the Art-A-Thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Agnes